who stayed behind. I'd always been homeschooled. The idea of dealing with lockers, schedules, textbooks, and cafeteria food on top of running the 21st Nome was just too much for me. You'd think the other kids would have complained, especially Sadie. But, in fact, attending school was working out okay for them. The girls were happy to have more friends and less dorky boys to flirt with, they claimed. The guys could play sports with actual teams rather than one-on-one with Hufu using Egyptian statues for hoops. As for Bost, she was happy to have a quiet house so she could stretch out on the floor and snooze in the sunlight. At any rate, by the time the others got home, I'd done a lot of thinking about my conversations with Zia and Horace. The plan I'd formulated last night still seemed crazy, but I decided that it might be our best shot. After briefing Sadie and Bost, who, disturbingly, agreed with me, we decided it was time to tell the rest of our friends. We gathered for dinner on the main terrace. It's a nice place to eat, with invisible barriers that keep out the wind and a great view of the East River in Manhattan. The food magically appeared, and it was always tasty. Still, I dreaded eating on the terrace. For 9 months, we'd had all our important meetings there. I'd come to associate sit-down dinners with disasters. We filled up our plates from the buffet as our guardian albino crocodile, Philip of Macedonia, splashed happily in his swimming pool. Eating next to a 20-foot-long crocodile took some getting used to, but Philip was well-trained. He only ate bacon, stray waterfowl, and the occasional invading monster. Bost sat at the head of the table with a can of Purina Fancy Feast. Sadie and I sat together at the opposite end. Hufu was off babysitting the ankle biters, and some of our newer recruits were inside doing their homework or catching up on spellcrafting. But most of our main people were present, a dozen senior initiates. Considering how badly last night had turned out, everyone seemed in strangely good spirits. I was kind of glad they didn't yet know about Sarah Jacoby's video death threat. Julian kept bouncing in his chair and grinning for no particular reason. Cleo and Jazz were whispering together and giggling. Even Felix seemed to have recovered from his shock in Dallas. He was sculpting tiny Shopty penguins out of his mashed potatoes and bringing them to life. Only Walt looked glum. The big guy had nothing on his dinner plate except 3 carrots and a wedge of Jell-O. Hufu insisted Jell-O had major healing properties. Judging from the tightness around Walt's eyes and the stiffness of his movements, I guessed his pain was even worse than last night. I turned to Sadie. "What's going on? Everybody seems distracted." She stared at me.
"I keep forgetting you don't go to school. Carter, it's the first dance tonight. 3 other schools will be there. We can hurry up the meeting, can't we?"
"You're kidding," I said. "I'm thinking about plans for Doomsday, and you're worried about being late to a dance?"
"I've mentioned it to you 12 times, she insisted. "Besides, we need something to boost our spirits. Now tell everyone your plan. Some of us still have to decide what to wear."
I wanted to argue, but the others were looking at me expectantly. I cleared my throat. "Okay, I know there's a dance, but..."
"At 7, Jazz said. "You are coming, right?"
She smiled at me. Was she flirting? Sadie just called me dense. "Hey, I had other things on my mind." So anyway, I stammered. "We need to talk about what happened in Dallas and what happens next." That killed the mood. The smiles faded. My friends listened as I reviewed our mission to the 51st Nome, the destruction of the Book of Overcoming Apophis, and the retrieval of the Shadow Box. I told them about Sarah Jacoby's demand for my surrender and the turmoil among the gods that Horace had mentioned. Sadie stepped in. She explained her weird encounter with the face in the wall, two gods, and our ghost mother. She shared her gut feeling that our best chance to defeat Apophis had something to do with shadows. Cleo raised her hand.
So, the rebel magicians have a death warrant out for you. The gods can't help us. Apophis could arise at any time, and the last scroll that might have helped us to defeat him has been destroyed. But we shouldn't worry, because we have an empty box and a vague hunch about shadows.
Why, Cleo,
Bast said with admiration,
you have a catty side.
I pressed my hands against the surface of the table. It would have taken very little effort to summon the strength of Horus and smash it to kindling. But I doubted that would help my reputation as a calm, collected leader. This is more than a vague hunch, I said. Look, you've all learned about execration spells, right? Our crocodile, Philip, grunted. He slapped the pool with his tail and made it rain on our dinner. Magical creatures are a little sensitive about the word execration. Julian dabbed the water off his grilled cheese sandwich.
Dude, you can't execrate Apophis. He's massive. Desjardins tried it and got killed.
I know, I said. With a standard execration, you destroy a statue that represents the enemy. But what if you could crank up the spell by destroying a more powerful representation, something more connected to Apophis? Walt sat forward, suddenly interested.
His shadow?
Felix was so startled, he dropped his spoon, crushing one of his mashed potato penguins.
Wait, what?
I got the idea from Horus, I said. He told me statues were called shadows in ancient times.
But that was just, like, symbolic, Alyssa said, wasn't it?
Bast set down her empty fancy feast can. She still looked nervous about the whole topic of shadows, but when I'd explained to her that it was either this or Sadie and me dying, she'd agreed to support us.
Maybe not, the cat goddess said. I'm no expert on execration, mind you. Nasty business. But it's possible that a statue used for execration was originally meant to represent the target's shadow, which is an important part of the soul.
So, Sadie said, we could cast an execration spell on Apophis, but instead of destroying a statue, we could destroy his actual shadow. Brilliant, eh?
That's nuts, Julian said. How do you destroy a shadow? Walt shooed a mashed potato penguin away from his jello.
It's not nuts. Sympathetic magic is all about using a small copy to manipulate the actual target. It's possible the whole tradition of making little statues to represent people and gods, maybe at one time those statues actually contained the target's soot. There are lots of stories about the souls of the gods inhabiting statues. If a shadow was trapped in a statue, you might be able to destroy it.
Could you make a statue like that? Alyssa asked. Something that could bind the shadow of Apophis himself?
Maybe.
Walt glanced at me. Most of the folks at the table didn't know we'd already made a statue of Apophis that might work for that purpose.
Even if I could, we'd need to find the shadow. Then we'd need some pretty advanced magic to capture it and destroy it.
Find a shadow?
Felix smiled nervously, like he hoped we were joking.
Wouldn't it be right under him? And how do you capture it? Step on it? Shine a light on it?
It'll be more complicated than that, I said. This ancient magician Setna, the guy who wrote his own version of the Book of Overcoming Apophis, I think he must have created a spell to catch and destroy shadows. That's why Apophis was so anxious to burn the evidence. That's his secret weakness.
But the scroll is gone, Cleo said.
There's still someone we can ask, Walt said. Toth. If anyone knows the answers, he will.
The tension around the table seemed to ease. At least we'd given our initiates something to hope for, even if it was a long shot. I was grateful we had Walt on our side. His charm-making ability might be our only hope of binding a shadow to the statue, and his vote of confidence carried weight with the other kids.
We need to visit Toth right away, I said, tonight.
Yes, Sadie agreed, right after the dance.
I glared at her. You aren't serious.
Oh, yes, brother dear.
She smiled mischievously, and for a second, I was afraid she might invoke my secret name and force me to obey.
We're attending the dance tonight, and you're coming with us.
5. A Dance with Death. Cheers, Carter. At least you have the sense to hand me the microphone for important things. Honestly, he drones on and on about his plans for the apocalypse, but he makes no plans at all for the school dance. My brother's priorities are severely skewed. I don't think I was being selfish wanting to go to the dance. Of course we had serious business to deal with. That's exactly why I insisted on partying first. Our initiates needed a morale boost. They needed a chance to be normal kids, to have friends and lives outside Brooklyn House, something worth fighting for. Even armies in the field fight better when they take breaks for entertainment. I'm sure some general somewhere has said that. By sunset, I was ready to lead my troops into battle. I'd picked out quite a nice black strapless dress and put black lowlights in my blonde hair with just a touch of dark makeup for that risen-from-the-grave look. I wore simple flats for dancing. Despite what Carter says, I do not wear combat boots all the time, just 90% of the time. The silver Tait amulet from my mother's jewelry box and the pendant Walt had given me for my last birthday with the Egyptian symbol of eternity, Shen. Walt had an identical amulet among his own collection of talismans, which provided us a magic line of communication and even the ability to summon the other person to our side in emergencies. Unfortunately, the Shen amulets didn't mean we were dating exclusively, or even dating at all. If Walt had asked me, I think I would have been fine with it. Walt was so kind and gorgeous, perfect, really, in his own way. Perhaps if he'd asserted himself a bit more, I would have fallen for him and been able to let go of that other boy, the godly one. But Walt was dying. He had this silly idea that it would be unfair to me if we started a relationship under those circumstances, as if that would stop me. So we were stuck in this maddening limbo, flirting, talking for hours, a few times even sharing a kiss when we let our guard down. But eventually Walt would always pull away and shut me out. Why couldn't things be simple? I bring this up because I literally ran into Walt as I was coming down the stairs. Oh, I said. Then I noticed he was still wearing his old muscle shirt, jeans, and no shoes. You're not ready yet?
I'm not going, he announced.
My mouth fell open. What? Why?
Sadie, you and Carter will need me when you visit Toth. If I'm going to make it, I have to rest.
But I forced myself to stop. It wasn't right for me to pressure him. I didn't need magic to see he really was in great pain. Centuries of magical healing knowledge at our disposal, yet nothing we tried seemed to help Walt. I ask you, what's the point of being a magician if you can't wave your wand and make the people you care about feel better? Right, I said. I was just hoping. Anything I said would have sounded bratty. I wanted to dance with him. Gods of Egypt, I dressed up for him. The mortal boys at school were all right, I suppose, but they seemed quite shallow compared to Walt, or, yes, fine, compared to Anubis. As for the other boys of Brooklyn House, dancing with them would have made me feel a bit odd, like I was dancing with my cousins. I could stay, I offered, but I suppose I didn't sound very convincing. Walt managed a faint smile.
No, go, Sadie. Really, I'm sure I'll be feeling better when you get back. Have a good time.
He brushed past me and climbed the steps. I took several deep breaths. Part of me did want to stay and look after him. Going without him didn't seem right. Then I glanced down into the great room. The older kids were joking and talking, ready to leave. If I didn't go, they might feel obliged to stay too. Something like wet cement settled in my stomach. All the joy and excitement suddenly went out of the evening for me. For months I'd been struggling to adjust to life in New York after so many years in London. I'd been forced to balance life as a young magician with the challenges of being an ordinary schoolgirl. Now, just when this dance had seemed to offer me a chance to combine both worlds and have a lovely night out, my hopes were dashed. I'd still have to go and pretend to have fun, but I'd only be doing it out of duty to make the others feel better. I wondered if this was what being a grown-up felt like. Horrible. The only thing that cheered me up was Carter. He emerged from his room dressed like a junior professor in a coat and tie, button-down shirt and trousers. Poor boy. Of course he'd never been to a dance any more than he'd been to school. He had no clue whatsoever. "You look wonderful," I tried to keep a straight face. "You do realize it's not a funeral?" "Shut up," he grumbled. "Let's get this over with." The school the kids and I attended was Brooklyn Academy for the Gifted. Everyone called it BAG. We had no end of jokes about this. The students were baggies. The glamour girls with nose jobs and Botox lips were plastic bags. Our alumni were old bags. And naturally, our headmistress, Mrs. Laird, was the bag lady. Despite the name, the school was quite nice. All the students were gifted in some sort of art, music, or drama. Our schedules were flexible, with lots of independent study time, which worked perfectly for us magicians. We could pop off to battle monsters as needed, and as magicians it wasn't difficult for us to pass ourselves off as gifted. Alyssa used her earth magic to make sculptures. Walt specialised in jewellery. Cleo was an amazing writer, since she could retell stories that had been forgot since the days of ancient Egypt. As for me, I needed no magic. I was a natural at drama.
Stop laughing, Carter!
You might not expect this in the middle of Brooklyn, but our campus was like a park, with acres of green lawns, well-tended trees and hedges, even a small lake with ducks and swans. The dance was held in the pavilion in front of the administration building. A band played in the gazebo. Lights were strung in the trees. Teacher chaperones walked the perimeter on bush patrol, making sure none of the older students sneaked off into the shrubbery. I tried not to think about it, but the music and crowd reminded me of Dallas the night before, a very different sort of party which had ended badly. I remembered J.D. Grissom clasping my hand, wishing me luck before he ran off to save his wife. Horrible guilt welled inside me. I forced it down. It wouldn't do the Grissoms any good for me to start crying in the middle of the dance. It certainly wouldn't help my friends enjoy themselves. As our group dispersed into the crowd, I turned to Carter, who was fiddling with his tie. "Right," I said, "you need to dance." Carter looked at me in horror. "What?" I called over one of my mortal friends, a lovely girl named Lacey. She was a year younger than I, so she looked up to me greatly. I know, it's hard not to. She had cute blonde pigtails, a mouthful of braces, and was possibly the only person at the dance more nervous than my brother. She'd seen pictures of Carter before, however, and seemed to find him hot. I didn't hold that against her. In most ways, she had excellent taste. "Lacey, Carter," I introduced them.
"You look like your pictures,"
Lacey grinned. The bands of her braces were alternating pink and white to match her dress. Carter said,
"He doesn't know how to dance,"
I told Lacey. "I'd be ever so grateful if you'd teach him."
"Sure,"
she squealed. She grabbed my brother's hand and swept him away. I started to feel better. Perhaps I could have fun tonight after all. Then I turned and found myself face to face with one of my not-so-favorite mortals, Drew Tanaka, head of the popular girl clique, with her supermodel goon squad in tow. Sadie! Drew threw her arm around me. Her perfume was a mixture of roses and tear gas. So glad you're here, sweetie. If I had known you were coming, you could have ridden in the limo with us. Her friends made sympathetic, "aww" sounds and grinned to show they were not at all sincere. They were dressed more or less the same, in the latest silky designer bits their parents had no doubt commissioned for them during the last fashion week. Drew was the tallest and most glamorous, I use the word as an insult, with awful pink eyeliner and frizzy black curls that were apparently Drew's own personal crusade to bring back the 1980s perm. She wore a pendant, a glittering platinum and diamond D, possibly her initial or her grade average. I gave her a tight smile. A limo, wow, thanks for that. But between you, your friends, and your egos, I doubt there would have been extra room. Drew pouted. That's not nice, hun. Where is Walt? Is the poor baby still sick? Behind her, some of the girls coughed into their fists, mimicking Walt. I wanted to pull my staff from the duot and turn them all into worms for the ducks. I was pretty sure I could manage that, and I doubted anyone would miss them, but I kept my temper. Lacey had warned me about Drew the first day of school. Apparently, the two of them had gone to some summer camp together, blah, blah, I didn't really listen to the details, and Drew had been just as much of a tyrant there. That did not, however, mean she could be a tyrant with me. Walt's at home, I said. I did tell him you'd be here. Funny, that didn't seem to motivate him much. What a shame, Drew sighed. You know, maybe he's not really sick. He might be just allergic to you, hon. That does happen. I should go to his place with some chicken soup or something. Where does he live? She smiled sweetly. I didn't know if she actually fancied Walt or if she just pretended because she hated me. Either way, the idea of turning her into an earthworm was becoming more appealing. Before I could do anything rash, a familiar voice behind me said, "Hello, Sadie." The other girls let out a collective gasp. My pulse quickened from slow walk to 50-meter dash. I turned and found that, yes, indeed, the god Anubis had crashed our dance. He had the nerve to look amazing, as usual. He's so annoying that way. He wore skinny black trousers with black leather boots and a biker's jacket over an Arcade Fire T-shirt. His dark hair was naturally disheveled as if he'd just woken up, and I fought the urge to run my fingers through it. His brown eyes glittered with amusement. Either he was happy to see me, or he enjoyed seeing me flustered. "Oh, my God!" Drew whimpered. "Who?" Anubis ignored her, bless him for that, and held out his elbow for me, a sweet old-fashioned gesture. "May I have this dance?" "I suppose," I said as noncommittally as I could. I looped my arm through his, and we left the plastic bags behind us, all of them muttering, "Oh, my God! God! Oh, my God! No, actually, I wanted to say, he's my amazingly hot boy god. Find your own." The uneven paving stones made for a dangerous dance floor. All around us, kids were tripping over each other. Anubis didn't help matters, as all the girls turned and gawked at him as he led me through the crowd. I was glad Anubis had my arm. My emotions were so jumbled I felt dizzy. I was ridiculously happy that he was here. I felt crushingly guilty that poor Walt was at home alone while I strolled arm in arm with Anubis, but I was relieved that Walt and Anubis weren't both here together. That would have been beyond awkward. The relief made me feel guiltier and so on. Gods of Egypt, I was a mess. As we reached the middle of the dance floor, the band suddenly switched from a dance number to a love ballad. "Was that your doing?" I asked Anubis. He smiled, which wasn't much of an answer. He put one hand on my hip and clasped my other hand like a proper gentleman. We swayed together. I'd heard of dancing on air, but it took me a few steps to realize we were actually levitating a few millimeters off the ground, not enough for anyone to notice, just enough for us to glide across the stones while others stumbled. A few meters away, Carter looked quite awkward as Lacey showed him how to slow dance. "Really, Carter, it isn't quantum physics."
I gazed up at Anubis's warm brown eyes and his exquisite lips. He'd kissed me once, for my birthday, last spring, and I'd never quite got over it. You'd think a god of death would have cold lips, but that wasn't the case at all. I tried to clear my head. I knew Anubis must be here for some reason, but it was awfully hard to focus. I thought... I gulped and barely managed not to drool on myself. Oh, brilliant, Sadie, I thought. Let's try for a complete sentence now, shall we? I thought you could only appear in places of death, I said. Anubis laughed gently.
This is a place of death, Sadie. The Battle of Brooklyn Heights, 1776. Hundreds of American and British troops died right where we're dancing.
How romantic, I muttered. So we're dancing on their graves?
Anubis shook his head. Most never received proper burials. That's why I decided to visit you here. These ghosts could use a night of entertainment, just like your initiates.
Suddenly, spirits were twirling all around us, luminous apparitions in 18th-century clothes. Some wore the red uniforms of British regulars. Others had ragtag militia outfits. They pirouetted with lady ghosts in plain farm dresses or fancy silk. A few of the posh women had piles of curly hair that would have made even Drew jealous. The ghosts seemed to be dancing to a different song. I strained my ears and could faintly hear violins and a cello. None of the regular mortals seemed to notice the spectral invasion. Even my friends from Brooklyn House were oblivious. I watched as a ghostly couple waltzed straight through Carter and Lacey. As Anubis and I danced, Brooklyn Academy seemed to fade and the ghosts became more real. One soldier had a musket wound in his chest. A British officer had a tomahawk sticking out of his powdered wig. We danced between worlds, waltzing side by side with smiling, gruesomely slaughtered phantoms. Anubis certainly knew how to show a girl a good time.
"You're doing it again," I said, "taking me out of phase, or whatever you call it."
"A little," he admitted. "We need privacy to talk. I promised you I'd visit in person."
"And you did.
But it's going to cause trouble. This may be the last time I can see you. There's been grumbling about our situation."
I narrowed my eyes. Was the god of the dead blushing? "Our situation," I repeated. "Us." The word set my ears buzzing. I tried to keep my voice even. "As far as I'm aware, there is no official us. Why would this be the last time we can talk?" He was definitely blushing now.
"Please, just listen. There's so much I need to tell you. Your brother has the right idea. The shadow of Apophis is your best hope, but only one person can teach you the magic you need. Toth may guide you somewhat, but I doubt he'll reveal the secret spells. It's too dangerous."
"Hold on, hold on." I was still reeling from the comment about us, and the idea that this might be the last time I saw Anubis. That set my brain cells into panic mode, thousands of tiny Sadies running around in my skull, screaming and waving their arms. I tried to focus.
"You mean Apophis does have a shadow? It could be used to execrate..."
"Please don't use that word." Anubis grimaced. "But yes, all intelligent entities have souls, so all of them have shadows, even Apophis. I know this much, being the guide of the dead. I have to make souls my business. Could his shadow be used against him? In theory, yes, but there are many dangers."
"Naturally." Anubis twirled me through a pair of colonial ghosts. Other students watched us, whispering as we danced, but their voices sounded distant and distorted, as if they were on the far side of a waterfall. Anubis studied me with a sort of tender regret.
"Sadie, I wouldn't set you on this path if there was another way. I don't want you to die."
"I can agree with that," I said.
"Even talking about this sort of magic is forbidden," he warned, "but you need to know what you're dealing with. The shut is the least understood part of the soul. It's, how to explain, a soul of last resort, an afterimage of the person's life force. You've heard that the souls of the wicked are destroyed in the Hall of Judgment."
"When a meat devours their hearts," I said.
"Yes."
Anubis lowered his voice.
"We say that this completely destroys the soul, but that's not true. The shadow lingers. Occasionally, not often, Osiris has decided to, review a judgment. If someone was found guilty, but new evidence comes to light, there must be a way to retrieve a soul from oblivion. I tried to grasp that. My thoughts felt suspended in mid-air, like my feet, not able to connect with anything solid. So, you're saying the shadow could be used to, reboot a soul? Like a computer's backup drive? Anubis looked at me strangely. I'm sorry, I sighed. I've been spending too much time with my geeky brother. He speaks like a computer. No, no, Anubis said. It's actually a good analogy. I'd just never thought of it that way. Yes, the soul isn't completely destroyed until the shadow is destroyed. So in extreme cases, with the right magic, it's possible to reboot the soul using the Schutt. Conversely, if you were to destroy a god's shadow, or even Apophis's shadow, as part of an the sort of spell you mentioned, the Schutt would be infinitely more powerful than a regular statue, I guessed. We could destroy him, possibly, without destroying ourselves. Anubis glanced around us nervously. Yes, but you can see why this sort of magic is secret. The gods would never want such knowledge in the hands of a mortal magician. This is why we always hide our shadows. If a magician were able to capture a god's Schutt and use it to threaten us... Right. My mouth felt dry. But I'm on your side. I'd only use the spell on Apophis. Surely Toth will understand that. Perhaps. Anubis didn't sound convinced. Start with Toth, at least. Hopefully he'll see the need to assist you. I fear, though, you may still need better guidance. More dangerous guidance. I gulped. You said only one person could teach us the magic. Who? The only magician crazy enough to ever research such a spell. His trial is tomorrow at sunset. You'll have to visit your father before then. Wait, what? Wind blew through the pavilion. Anubis's hand tightened on mine. We have to hurry, he said. There's more I need to tell you. Something is happening with the spirits of dead. They're being... Look there! He pointed to a pair of nearby spectres. The woman danced barefoot in a simple white linen dress. The man wore breeches and a frock coat like a colonial farmer, but his neck was canted at a funny angle, as if he'd been hanged. Black mist coiled around the man's legs like ivy. Another three waltz steps, and he was completely engulfed. The murky tendrils pulled him into the ground, and he disappeared. The woman in white kept dancing by herself, apparently unaware that her partner had been consumed by evil fingers of Smog. What was that? I asked. We don't know, Anubis said. As Apophis grows stronger, it's happening more frequently. Souls of the dead are disappearing, being drawn farther down into the Duat. We don't know where they're going. I almost stumbled. My mother, is she all right? Anubis gave me a pained look, and I knew the answer. Mum had warned me. We might never see her again unless we discovered a way to defeat Apophis. She'd sent me that message, urging me to find the serpent's shadow. It had to be connected to her dilemma somehow. She's missing, I guessed. My heart pounded against my ribs. It's got something to do with this business about shadows, hasn't it? Sadie, I wish I knew. Your father is... He's trying his best to find her, but the wind interrupted him. Have you ever stuck your hand out of a moving car and felt the air push against you? It was a bit like that, but 10 times more powerful. A wedge of force pushed Anubis and me apart. I staggered backward, my feet no longer levitating. Sadie! Anubis reached out, but the wind pushed him farther away. Stop that! Said a squeaky voice between us. No public displays of affection on my watch! The air took on human form. At first it was just a faint silhouette, then it became more solid and colourful. Before me stood a man in an old-fashioned aviator's outfit, leather helmet, goggles, scarf, and a bomber's jacket, like photos I'd seen of the Royal Air Force pilots during World War II. He wasn't flesh and blood, though. His form swirled and shifted. I realized he was put together from blown rubbish. Specks of dirt, scraps of paper, bits of dandelion fuzz, dried leaves, all churning about, but held together in such a tight collage by the wind that from a distance he might have passed for a normal mortal. He wagged his finger at Anubis.
"This is the final insult, boy!"
His voice hissed like air from a balloon. "You have been warned numerous times!"
"Hold on," I said. "Who are you? And Anubis is hardly a boy. He's 5,000 years old."
"Exactly," the aviator snapped. "A mere child, and I didn't give you permission to speak, girl."
The aviator exploded. The blast was so powerful my ears popped and I fell on my bum. Around me, the other mortals, my friends, teachers, and all the students, simply collapsed. Anubis and the ghosts seemed unaffected. The aviator formed again, glaring down at me. I struggled to my feet and tried to summon my staff from the Duat. No such luck. "What have you done?" I demanded.
"Sadie, it's all right," Anubis said. "Your friends are only unconscious. Shu just lowered the air pressure."
"Shu?" I demanded. "Shu who?" Anubis pressed his fingers to his temples.
"Sadie, this is Shu, my great-grandfather."
Then it struck me. Shu was one of those ridiculous godly names I'd heard before. I tried to place it. "Ah, the god of flip-flops. No, wait. Leaky balloons? No.
Air!" Shu hissed. "God of the air!"
His body dissolved into a tornado of debris. When he formed again, he was in ancient Egyptian costume, bare-chested with a white loincloth and a giant ostrich feather sprouting from his braided headband. He changed back into RAF clothes.
"Stick with the pilot's outfit," I said. "The ostrich feather really doesn't work for you."
Shu made an unfriendly whooshing sound.
"I'd prefer to be invisible, thank you very much, but you mortals have polluted the air so badly it's getting harder and harder. It's dreadful what you've done the last few millennia. Haven't you people heard of Spare the Air Days, carpooling, hybrid engines? And don't get me started on cows. Did you know that every cow belches and farts over 100 gallons of methane a day? There are 1.5 billion cows in the world. Do you have any idea what that does to my respiratory system?"
From his jacket pocket, Shu produced an inhaler and puffed on it.
"Shocking!"
I raised an eyebrow at Anubis, who looked mortally embarrassed, or perhaps immortally embarrassed.
"Shu," he said, "we were just talking. If you'll let us finish..."
"Oh! Talking!"
Shu bellowed, no doubt releasing his own share of methane.
"While holding hands and dancing and other degenerate behaviour? Don't play innocent, boy. I've been a chaperone before, you know. I kept your grandparents apart for eons."
Suddenly I remembered the story of Nut and Jeb, the sky and earth. Ra had commanded Nut's father, Shu, to keep the two lovers apart so they would never have children who might someday usurp Ra's throne. That strategy hadn't worked, but apparently Shu was still trying. The air guard waved his hand in disgust at the unconscious mortals, some of whom were just starting to groan and stir.
"And now, Anubis, I find you in this den of iniquity, this morass of questionable behaviour, this...
"School?" I suggested.
"Yes!"
Shu nodded so vigorously his head disintegrated into a cloud of leaves.
"You heard the decree of the gods, boy. You've become entirely too close to this mortal. You are hereby banned from further contact."
"What?" I shouted. "That's ridiculous! Who decreed this?" Shu made a sound like a blown-out tire. Either he was laughing or giving me a windy raspberry.
"The entire council, girl, led by Lord Horus and Lady Isis."
I felt as if I were dissolving into scraps of rubbish myself.
Isis and Horus? I couldn't believe it. Stabbed in the back by my two supposed friends.
Isis and I were going to have words about this. I turned to Anubis, hoping he'd tell me it was a lie. He raised his hands miserably.
"Sadie, I was trying to tell you. Gods are not allowed to become directly, involved with mortals. That's only possible when a god inhabits a human form, and as you know, I've never worked that way."
I gritted my teeth. I wanted to argue that Anubis had quite a nice form, but he'd told me often that he could only manifest in dreams or in places of death. Unlike other gods, he'd never taken a human host. It was so bloody unfair. We hadn't even dated properly. One kiss 6 months ago, and Anubis was grounded from seeing me forever.
You can't be serious.
I'm not sure who made me angrier, the fussy air god chaperone or Anubis himself. You're not really going to let them rule you like this.
He has no choice, Shu cried.
The effort made him cough so badly his chest exploded into dandelion fluff. He took another blast from his inhaler.
Brooklyn ozone levels. Deplorable. Now off with you, Anubis. No more contact with this mortal. It is not proper. And as for you, girls, stay away from him. You have more important things to do.
Oh, yes, I said. And what about you, Mr. Trash Tornado? We're preparing for war, and the most important thing you can do is keep people from waltzing. The air pressure rose suddenly. Blood roared in my head.
See here, girl, Shu growled. I've already helped you more than you deserve. I heeded that Russian boy's prayer. I brought him here all the way from St. Petersburg to speak with you. So, sure.
The wind blasted me backward. The ghosts blew away like smoke. The unconscious mortals began to stir, shielding their faces from the debris. "Russian boy!" I shouted over the gale. "What on earth are you talking about?" Shu disbanded into rubbish and swirled around Anubis, lifting him off his feet. "Sadie!" Anubis tried to fight his way toward me, but the storm was too strong. "Shu, at least let me tell her about Walt. She has a right to know!" I could barely hear him above the wind. "Did you say Walt?" I shouted. "What about him?" Anubis said something I couldn't make out. Then the flurry of debris completely obscured him. When the wind died, both gods were gone. I stood alone on the dance floor, surrounded by dozens of kids and adults who were starting to wake up. I was about to run to Carter to make sure he was all right. "Yes, Carter, honestly, I was." Then, at the edge of the pavilion, a young man stepped into the light. He wore a grey military outfit with a wool coat too heavy for the warm September night. His enormous ears seemed to be the only things holding up his oversized hat. A rifle was slung across his shoulder. He couldn't have been more than 17, and though he was definitely not from any of the schools at the dance, he looked vaguely familiar. "St. Petersburg," Shu had said. Yes, I'd met this boy briefly last spring. Carter and I had been running from the Hermitage Museum. This boy had tried to stop us. He'd been disguised as a guard, but revealed himself as a magician from the Russian gnome, one of the servants of the evil Vlad Menshikov. I grabbed my staff from the Duat, successfully this time. The boy raised his hands in surrender.
Niet,
he pleaded. Then, in halting English, he said,
Sidikin, we need to talk.
6. Amos plays with action figures. His name was Leonid, and we agreed not to kill each other. We sat on the steps of the gazebo and talked while the students and teachers struggled to wake up around us. Leonid's English was not good. My Russian was non-existent, but I understood enough of his story to be alarmed. He'd escaped the Russian gnome and somehow convinced Shu to whisk him here to find me. Leonid remembered me from our invasion of the Hermitage. Apparently, I'd made a strong impression on the young man. No surprise, I am rather memorable. Oh, stop laughing, Carter. Using words, hand gestures, and sound effects, Leonid tried to explain what had happened in St. Petersburg since the death of Vlad Menshikov. I couldn't follow it all, but this much I understood. Kwai, Jacobi, Apophis, first gnome, many deaths, soon, very soon. Teachers began corralling students and calling parents. Apparently, they feared the mass blackout might have been caused by bad punch or hazardous gas, Drew's perfume, perhaps, and they'd decided to evacuate the area. I suspected we'd have police and paramedics on the scene shortly. I wanted to be gone before then. I dragged Leonid over to meet my brother, who was stumbling around, rubbing his eyes.
"What happened?"
Carter asked. He scowled at Leonid.
"Who?"
I gave him the one-minute version. Anubis's visit, Shu's intervention, the Russian's appearance. "Leonid has information about an impending attack on the first gnome," I said. "The rebels will be after him."
Carter scratched his head. "You want to hide him at Brooklyn House?"
"No," I said. "I've got to take him to Amos straight away." Leonid choked.
"Amos? He turn into Set. Eat face?"
"Amos will not eat your face," I assured him. "Jacoby's been telling you stories." Leonid still looked uneasy.
"Amos not become Set?"
How to explain without making it sound worse? I didn't know the correct Russian for "he was possessed by Set, but it wasn't his fault and he's much better now." "No Set," I said. "Good, Amos." Carter studied the Russian. He looked at me with concern.
"Sadie, what if this is a trap? You trust this guy?"
"Oh, I can handle Leonid. He doesn't want me to morph him into a banana slug, do you, Leonid?"
"Nyet,"
Leonid said solemnly. "No banana slug." "There, you see?"
"What about visiting Toth?" Carter asked. "That can't wait."
I saw the worry in his eyes. I imagined he was thinking the same thing I was. Our mum was in trouble. The spirits of the dead were disappearing, and it had something to do with the shadow of Apophis. We had to find the connection. "You visit Toth," I said. "Take Walt, and, keep an eye on him, all right? Anubis wanted to tell me something about him, but there wasn't time. And in Dallas, when I looked at Walt in the Duat, I couldn't make myself finish. Just thinking about Walt wrapped in mummy linen brought tears to my eyes. Fortunately, Carter seemed to get the general idea.
"I'll keep him safe,"
he promised. "How will you get to Egypt?" I pondered that. Leonid had apparently flown here via Shu Airways, but I doubted that fussy aviator god would be willing to help me, and I didn't want to ask. "We'll risk a portal," I said. "I know they've been a bit wonky, but it's just one quick jump. What could go wrong?"
"You could materialize inside a wall," Carter said, "or wind up scattered through the Duat in a million pieces."
"Why, Carter, you care. But really, we'll be fine, and we haven't got much choice." I gave him a quick hug, I know, horribly sentimental, but I wanted to show solidarity. Then, before I could change my mind, I took Leonid's hand and raced across campus. My head was still spinning from my talk with Anubis. How dare Isis and Horus keep us apart when we weren't even together? And what had Anubis wanted to tell me about Walt? Perhaps he'd wanted to end our ill-fated relationship and give his blessing for me to date Walt. Lame. Or perhaps he wanted to declare his undying love and fight Walt for my affections. Highly unlikely, nor would I appreciate being fought over like a basketball. Or perhaps, most probable, he'd wanted to break some bad news. Anubis had visited Walt on several occasions that I knew of. They'd both been rather tight-lipped about what was discussed, but since Anubis was the guide of the dead, I assumed he'd been preparing Walt for death. Anubis might have wanted to warn me that the time was nigh, as if I needed another reminder. Anubis, off-limits. Walt, at death's door. If I lost both of the guys I liked, well, there wasn't much point in saving the world. All right, that was a slight exaggeration, but only slight. On top of that, my mum was in trouble, and Sarah Jacoby's rebels were planning some horrible attack on my uncle's headquarters. Why then did I feel so hopeful? An idea started to tug at me, a tiny glimmer of possibility. It wasn't just the prospect that we might find a way to defeat the serpent. Anubis's words kept playing in my mind.
"The shadow lingers. There must be a way to retrieve a soul from oblivion."
If a shadow could be used to bring back a mortal soul that had been destroyed, could it do the same for a god? I was so lost in thought, I barely noticed when we reached the Fine Arts building. Leonid stopped me.
"This for portal?"
He pointed to a block of carved limestone in the courtyard. "Yes," I said. "Thanks."
Long story short, when I started at Bag, I reckoned it would be good to have an Egyptian relic close by for emergencies, so I did the logical thing. I borrowed a chunk of limestone frieze from the nearby Brooklyn Museum. Honestly, the museum had enough rocks. I didn't think they'd missed this one. I'd left a facsimile in its place and asked Alyssa to present the actual Egyptian frieze to her art teacher as her class project, an attempt to simulate an ancient art form. The teacher had been duly impressed. He'd installed Alyssa's artwork in the courtyard outside his classroom. The carving showed mourners at a funeral, which I thought appropriate for a school setting. It wasn't a powerful or important piece of art, but all relics of ancient Egypt have some amount of power, like magical batteries. With the right training, a magician can use them to jumpstart spells that would otherwise be impossible, such as opening portals. I got rather good at this particular magic. Leonid watched my back as I began to chant. Most magicians wait for auspicious moments to open gates. They spend years memorizing a timetable of important anniversaries, like the time of day each god was born, the alignment of the stars and whatnot. I suppose I should have worried about such things, but I didn't. Given the thousands of years of Egyptian history, there were so many auspicious moments that I simply chanted until I hit one. Of course, I had to hope my portal didn't open during an inauspicious moment. That could have caused all sorts of nasty side effects. But what's life without taking a few risks? Carter is shaking his head and muttering. I have no idea why. The air rippled in front of us. A circular doorway appeared, a swirling vortex of golden sand, and Leonid and I jumped through. I'd like to say my spell worked perfectly and we ended up in the first gnome. Sadly, I was a bit off the mark. The portal spit us out roughly 100 meters above Cairo. I found myself free-falling through the cool night air toward the city lights below. I didn't panic. I could have cast any number of spells to get out of this situation. I could have even assumed the form of a kite, the bird of prey, not the kind with a string, although that wasn't my favourite way to travel. Before I could decide on a plan of action, Leonid grabbed my hand. The direction of the wind changed. Suddenly, we were gliding over the city in a controlled descent. We set down softly in the desert just outside the city limits near a cluster of ruins that I knew from experience hid an entrance to the first gnome. I looked at Leonid in amazement. You summoned the power of Shu.
Shu, he said grimly. Yes, necessary. I do forbidden.
I smiled with delight. You clever boy. You learned the path of the gods on your own. I knew there was a reason I didn't turn you into a banana slug. Leonid's eyes widened.
No banana slug, please.
It was a compliment, silly, I said. Forbidden is good. Sadie likes forbidden. Now come on, you need to meet my uncle. No doubt Carter would describe the underground city in excruciating detail, with exact measurements of each room, boring history on every statue and hieroglyph, and background notes on the construction of the magical headquarters of the House of Life. I will spare you that pain. It's big, it's full of magic, it's underground. There, sorted. At the bottom of the entry tunnel, we crossed a stone bridge over a chasm, where I was challenged by a bar. The glowing bird spirit, with the head of a famous Egyptian I probably should have known, asked me a question. What colour are the eyes of Anubis? Brown? Duh! I suppose he was trying to trick me with an easy question. The bar let us pass into the city proper. I hadn't visited in 6 months, and I was distressed to see how few magicians were about. The first gnome had never been crowded. Egyptian magic had withered over the centuries as fewer and fewer young initiates learned the arts. But now most shops in the central cavern were closed. At the market stalls, no one was haggling over the price of ankhs or scorpion venom. A bored-looking amulet salesman perked up as we approached, then slumped as we passed by. Our footsteps echoed in the silent tunnels. We crossed one of the subterranean rivers, then wound our way through the library quarter and the Chamber of Birds. Carter says I should tell you why it's called that. It's a cave full of all sorts of birds. Again, duh. Carter, why are you banging your head against the table?
I brought my Russian friend down a long corridor, past a sealed tunnel that had once led up to the Great Sphinx of Giza, and finally to the bronze doors of the Hall of Ages. It was my uncle's hall now, so I strolled right in. Impressive place? Certainly. If you filled it with water, the hall would have been large enough for a pod of whales. Running down the middle, a long blue carpet glittered like the River Nile. Along either side marched rows of columns, and between them shimmered curtains of light displaying scenes from Egypt's past, all sorts of horrible, wonderful, heart-wrenching events. I tried to avoid looking at them. I knew from experience that those images could be dangerously absorbing. Once I'd made the mistake of touching the lights, and the experience had almost turned my brain into oatmeal. The first section of light was gold, the age of the gods. Farther along, the old kingdom glowed silver, then the middle kingdom in coppery brown, and so on. Several times as we walked, I had to pull Leonid back from scenes that caught his eye. Honestly, I wasn't much better. I got teary-eyed when I saw a vision of Bess entertaining the other gods by doing cartwheels in a loincloth. I cried because I missed seeing him so full of life, I mean, though the sight of Bess in a loincloth is enough to make anyone's eyes burn. We passed the bronze curtain of light for the new kingdom. I stopped abruptly. In the shifting mirage, a thin man in priestly robes held a wand and a knife over a black bull. The man muttered as if blessing the animal. I couldn't tell much about the scene, but I recognized the man's face. A beaky nose, high forehead, thin lips that twisted in a wicked smile as he ran the knife along the poor animal's throat. "That's him," I muttered. I walked toward the curtain of light. "Nyet!" Leonid grabbed my arm. "You tell me the lights are bad. Stay away." "You're right," I said. "But that's Uncle Vinny." I was positive it was the same face that had appeared in the wall at the Dallas Museum. But how could that be? The scene I was looking at must have happened thousands of years ago.
"Not Vinny," Leonid said. "Kaim was it."
Sorry? I wasn't sure if I'd heard him correctly, or even in what language he'd spoken. "Is that a name?"
"He is..."
Leonid slipped into Russian, then sighed in exasperation.
"Too difficult to explain. Let us see Amos, who will not eat my face."
I forced myself to look away from the image.
"Good idea. Let's keep going."
At the end of the hall, the curtains of red light for the modern age changed to dark purple. Supposedly, this marked the beginning of a new age, though none of us knew exactly what sort of era it would be. If Apophis destroyed the world, I guessed it would be the age of extremely short lives. I'd expected to see Amos sitting at the foot of the pharaoh's throne. That was the traditional place for the chief lector, symbolizing his role as the pharaoh's main adviser. Of course, the pharaohs rarely needed advising these days, as they'd all been dead for several thousand years. The dais was empty. That stumped me. I'd never considered where the chief lector hung out when he wasn't on display. Did he have a dressing room, possibly with his name and a little star on the door?
"There,"
Leonid pointed. Once again, my clever Russian friend was right. On the back wall, behind the throne, a faint line of light shone along the floor, the bottom edge of a door.
"A creepy secret entrance," I said. "Well done, Leonid."
On the other side, we found a sort of war room. Amos and a young woman in camouflage clothes stood at opposite ends of a large table inlaid with a full-color world map. The table's surface was crowded with tiny figurines, painted ships, monsters, magicians, cars, and markers with hieroglyphs. Amos and the camouflage girl were so engrossed in their work, moving figurines across the map, they didn't notice us at first. Amos wore traditional linen robes. With his barrel-shaped figure, they made him look a bit like Friar Tuck, except with darker skin and cooler hair. His braided locks were decorated with gold beads. His round glasses flashed as he studied the map. Draped around his shoulders was the leopard-skin cape of the chief lector. As for the young woman... Oh,
gods of Egypt! It was Zia!
I'd never seen her in modern clothes before. She wore camouflage cargo pants, hiking boots, and an olive-coloured tank top that flattered her coppery skin.
Her black hair was longer than I remembered. She looked so much more grown up and gorgeous than she'd been 6 months ago. I was glad Carter hadn't come along. He would have had difficulty picking up his jaw from the floor. Yes, you would have, Carter. She looked quite stunning in a commando girl sort of a way. Amos moved one of the figurines across the map.
Here,
he told Zia.
All right,
she said.
But that leaves Paris undefended.
I cleared my throat. Are we interrupting? Amos turned and broke into a grin.
Sadie.
He crushed me in a hug, then rubbed my head affectionately. Ow, I said. He chuckled.
I'm sorry. It's just so good to see you.
He glanced at Leonid.